From the team at CTS, this is the Time Crunch Cyclist Podcast, our show dedicated to answering your training questions and providing actionable advice to help you improve your performance, even if you're strapped for time. I'm your host, Coach Adam Pulford, and I'm one of the over 50 professional coaches who make up the team at CTS. In each episode, I draw on our team's collective knowledge, other coaches, and experts in the field to provide you with the practical ways to get the most out of your training and ultimately become the best cyclist that you can be. Now, on to our show. What up, Time Crunch fans, and welcome back. I'm your host, Coach Adam Pulford, and I'm with CTS Premier Coach Renee Eastman once again. This is part two of a three-part series exploring the value of lab testing for endurance athletes. More than just training and performance benefits, there are health benefits as well as longevity aspects to consider here. So we'll do a quick recap of what we talked about last week in part one. But if you missed it, be sure to go back and listen, because all this stuff that we talk about today will make a lot more sense. So Renee, let's start by recapping last week. First, what is lactate and why do we care about it? Just in the most simplistic terms.
Lactate is a byproduct of metabolism. Specifically, it's a byproduct of carbohydrate metabolism. We kind of have that general idea of like we use more fat when it's easy, and as exercise intensity goes up, we start using carbohydrates more. So if lactate levels are going up, it's telling us when we're using more carbohydrates, and when they get to a real high level, it indicates when we're going from aerobic metabolism to more preferentially anaerobic metabolism.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's a great answer. And so why do we test lactate during a lab test, which we'll get into a little bit more, but what's the phenomenon that we're able to test with that carbohydrate metabolism found in lactate?
Yeah. So when we're going at like easy to moderate intensity, I'm going to say it's like zone one and two for people who understand. We generally see lactates kind of just hover around what we call a baseline, just like bounce around, don't get too much higher. But then when we see our first tick up in blood lactate concentration, it's an indication that we go from more fat metabolism to more predominantly carbohydrate metabolism. So that's the first tick up. We call that the aerobic threshold, or LT1. That's another way to phrase it. And that's just like, oh, my lactate levels are elevated. And then what probably most people are more familiar with are the what we call, quote, in quotes, lactate threshold, or FTP, or anaerobic threshold, where that's the point above which blood lactate just really skyrockets. So there's a point where lactate levels tick up. Oh, I'm still working mostly aerobically, but I'm using more carbohydrates. And lactate threshold, it really skyrockets. Oh, I'm using more anaerobic metabolism, because the aerobic metabolism can't keep up with the energy demands. It denotes different phases of your exercise intensity, which correlates to the zones that we prescribe for people for training.
Yeah, that's a perfect summation. And, you know, to what we, I don't know, maybe blew some minds of people listening, there are two lactate turn points or thresholds in the body, LT1 and LT2, but that LT2 is more in line with that lactate threshold, or threshold power, so to speak. Yeah. So last week as well, we kind of ran through kind of a mock scenario of somebody being tested in a lab. But if we were to kind of tighten that up a little bit, Renee, and if someone has never had a lab test done before, could you just explain maybe the difference between lab testing and Empower field testing and what a typical lab test looks like?
Yeah, it's a great question. And our typical field testing, you know, you're doing it with your power meter at home. got your 8-minute field test or your 20-minute test, like some kind of medium duration test, where we take a raw percentage of that to say, oh, 90% of an 8-minute test is what we would call your lactate threshold or LT2. And if you can do X for 8 minutes or Y for 20 minutes, then 90% or 75% or whatever kind of raw percent is to say that's what should be zone 2 or zone 3 or zone 4. And the difference in the lab is we're actually measuring those points for you as an individual. So, you know, the numbers that come up real quick for me is that if I'm determining somebody's lactate threshold in the lab, their zone 2 power could be anywhere from 65 to 80% of their FTP power. Where if we're just doing that raw calculation, we just say, bam, 75%. So we're actually measuring where that's happening for you. And how we determine that, a lab test would typically be a ramp protocol. That means it gets a little harder every stage. And the stages are usually 3 to 5 minutes. And they increase, quote, a little every stage. And it's 15 to 25 watts a stage, and it's like a little bit relative to what power somebody can do. You know, if your threshold's at 150 or 70 watts, we're going to do short ramps. And if it's 400 watts, we're going to do big jumps. So progressive ramp test. And at CTS, we take somebody right to maximum on that test. In another podcast, debate the protocol we use.
Yes, but we will not go there today. However, I've been in the room with you, Lindsay, and others where we do debate the proper protocol. However, like for our listeners, they're like, okay, I would say straight to the point, why this matters for you listening is if you're all about the individuality of training and coaching, which we talk about on this podcast, this is another step toward that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, having your own power meter and your own kind of customized ranges, it's well known and well established on how you make anaerobic power, how drastically that varies. We talk about a time trialer phenotype, an all-rounder, a sprinter, you know, somebody who just has more anaerobic capability than you. And so what Renee's talking about here is the part sub-threshold or the aerobic part of how to customize and learn more about your physiology. And I think that that is what the biggest power of lab testing is all about. So Renee, you said you bring them up to max during the ramp protocol. Does that mean you're testing VO2 max in conjunction with this, or is that a separate test alone?
At this point, we do a combo test where we're trying to get all that data at once. And so VO2, that actually means oxygen consumption rate.
Yeah. So volume of oxygen. Yep.
Yeah. They're breathing into a tube, into our machine. We're able to say how much oxygen they're pulling out of the air.
Yep.
You know, just by what they're breathing out. So we're measuring that oxygen consumption rate. The other thing, you know, we're measuring heart rate. We know what their wattage is. And then we're taking an actual blood lactate measurement, fingertip, you know, just a little drop of blood off the fingertip. So we're measuring those additional factors other than just power. So about their physiology, like how their body's producing the power.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is super cool. You know, it's rather than just wattage coming out. And, you know, a lot of people are measuring heart rate and in speed and cadence. I mean, you're taking all that, but then you got the gas exchanges that are going on in your actual body as well as the lactate production. So again, audience members, if you want customized individual coaching, we got it for you. Anyway, recap a lab test. You got ramp-based protocol. We're testing LT1, LT2. We're testing VO2. So is lab test better than the field test then? Is that our message to our audience? Should we just forego field testing altogether now or what?
I think field testing is pretty awesome. You know,
agreed.
And yeah, and for a lot of years, we saw a decline in people coming into the lab. Because I think the field testing and then how you can train based off of percentage of FTP, that gets you pretty close. No. But I want to say, yeah, the people who are at the next level or want to take themselves to the next level, maybe the VO2 max, the lactate threshold testing could be a pathway to that. If you find yourself, you know, you get up to 250 watts FTP every single year. Like, that's just like where you get up to every year. You train up to that level and you just kind of plateau at that level. Like, well, could you push to a higher level, and how could you push to that higher level? Often the answers are below your FTP. And those are the questions that the lab testing can answer, I believe, is in part what, like, how big is your engine and what capacity your engine has, and can we tweak that? And that has to do with fat and carbohydrate metabolism, and I'm sure we're going to get into that a little bit, Adam, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's go there then, because we're talking about learning how the engine runs, not just the fact that it is running or how fast it can run, right? It's, we're learning why it is. And then we'll have some tools on how to tune that engine to get it to run more the way we want to. So when we're talking about this sub-threshold tweaking, which is even below L2, and now we're talking L1, what is that? What are the functions there? And I'm going to go right to like metabolic efficiency, and you may have a better term for it. But what are you measuring when it comes to this metabolism of the human body? Like, what the heck are we talking about? How do you do it?
So back to your, you know, the FTP testing, the 20-minute testing, things like that. That tells us great information about, like, what can you do for an hour? Or what can you do for 5 minutes? Or what can you do for 2 minutes? But most of our events are much longer than an hour for the people who are most likely listening to the podcast.
Yeah.
You know, maybe
sometimes 10 hours.
but yeah, I mean, we're getting a lot of, you know, Leadville or Steamboat Gradville or whatever. Yeah. So the limiter for that level of performance is, if I want to put it in a really simple way, is your metabolic efficiency, the efficiency of your mitochondria. And mitochondria efficiency, that's in your slow twitch muscle fibers, because those are the ones that use fat as a fuel. And as we know, fat is a near unlimited fuel source for even the leanest of athletes.
Yep.
We can hours and hours, days and days run on fat as fuel. Carbohydrates limited, you know, 1.5, 2 hours for most people. So when we're talking about performance in endurance events longer than 2 or 3 hours, one of your limiters is going to be your body's ability to run on fat as a fuel. And that's controlled by your mitochondrial density and efficiency of your slow twitch fibers. And that's something that doesn't come up in a power duration curve, but I can tell you about from a performance test.
Exactly. I was just going to say, yeah, can't see that in a power meter. But how do you test it in a lab? Like, how do you show that to an athlete?
When we are observing oxygen consumption rate, we get a thing called RER or RQ, respiratory exchange ratio. And that is the carbon dioxide and oxygen ratio. And you don't need to know about, like, the numbers and things like that. But it tells us how much fat and carbohydrate that you're utilizing at any given intensity. So we're doing this progressive test, and we can say, oh, at 100 watts, you're using 70% fat and 30% carbohydrate. Or we could also express it in the absolute range. Like, oh, I can do X amount of grams of fat per minute. So essentially, if you're able to use a greater amount of fat per minute or per hour, however you want to conceptualize it, that means that you are more metabolically efficient. And another result that we would see in the lab from that is a lower lactate response. Lactate, again, it's a byproduct of carbohydrate metabolism. So when you're using carbohydrates at a faster rate, we see higher lactates as well.
Gotcha. So in an ideal world, you bring somebody into the lab, they're going easy, they're breathing into the tube, and you've got something on the screen telling you, okay, this person is burning more fat as a fuel source. This is good. great. What do you see when it's bad? Like what?
Really good. And this is where we, you know, in our vernacular, we say sugar burners and fat burners.
Sugar burners.
When I see somebody who has what we call good metabolic efficiency, they would be able to burn fat at a high absolute rate, just a absolute how many grams per minute in fat that they can burn. And they keep burning that in the lower stages. And I like that term metabolic flexibility because we've been focusing on, oh, burning fat as a fuel source is great. But most of our races aren't won only on that. You have to be able to also burn carbohydrates. So we might get to that in our next segment. But I want to see somebody, when I see somebody is able to burn fat at a high rate, it's within a certain confines of their VO2 max. And, you know, if I want to put a number on it, that probably means nothing to anybody here, it's like over half a gram per minute. And if I can see them burning up to like 0.678 grams a minute, I'm like, no, they're pretty, quote, metabolically efficient. They have a high rate of being able to burn fat as a fuel source. And that's an indication that their mitochondria are working great. And yeah, they can run on fat as a fuel source. And yeah, that's great for an endurance athlete. It's also great for us as humans to be able to run on fat as a fuel source.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like from an evolutionary standpoint, how our storage systems have like equip themselves, right? And so it makes sense here. And to kind of recap that is like from easy going up harder, like the kind of the higher intensity that you can still burn fat as a primary fuel source, that's beneficial. So when you get a sugar burner, two things. One, like what are you seeing in the data?
Yeah.
Like are they just like burning more carbohydrate at yeah, rest? And then two, like what causes that?
Yes, I am. I might see their a sugar burner, as I would call it, is just maybe just right from go. They're more than 50% of their energy is provided by carbohydrate. That could be at like for most athletes starting at 75 or 100 watts, or maybe it's 100, 125 watts, like well below their what we call FTP. And they're just, they can produce a lot of energy. It's just coming mostly from carbohydrate. Performance wise, that's not desirable because carbohydrate is a limited energy source for us. And, you know, I might also see their fat oxidation rates suppress earlier in their test than later in their test. You know, if I saw somebody who was, quote, good at fat burning, I might see their fat oxidation rates peak around that 75 or 80% of their FTP. Mm-hmm. That typically what we're calling zone two.
Yeah, top end of zone two. Yep.
Yeah. But if I see somebody who's more of a sugar burner, I may see their peak fat oxidation rate go at 50, 60% of their threshold. And that just means that they have to shift to sugar faster because their mitochondria just can't keep up of the energy demands.
So then they would have to, they're depleting carbohydrate quicker. So they would either have to fuel more.
Yep.
Or changes their training over time. So what, but they could still perform well as long as they had enough carbohydrate on board, right?
Yeah, they could perform well for a while.
So my question is, okay, so we have like, they can still perform. You got the person who's just like eating a ton on the group ride and like, but they're still hammering. Let's put performance aside here. When you see a sugar burner in the lab, what are some of like the health and longevity implications of not being able to burn fat as a fuel source at rest or easy conditions as well as moderate to high?
You know, I'm not a medical doctor, first of all, or a medical professional. So.
Oh, wait, like I need to get somebody Climber, else on here.
Right, right. But I tend to see the people with higher lactates at rest or early exercise, although like sugar burners, as we're calling, more insulin resistant. they might be the people who are maybe pre-diabetic, have an inability to control their blood sugar, perhaps, and just maybe struggle to lose weight as well. Maybe yep. they're like, they struggle to reduce their caloric intake because they're just always hungry all the time. And it's not so much the total calories, it's just that they're not able to tap into those stored fats as easily as somebody else because they just want to run on sugar more so than the fat.
Yeah, agreed. And I would say, yeah, kind of staying in our lane here, they could be very lean athletes, but they could be overweight athletes that are sugar burners. There's no necessarily correlation there. It's more about the long-term implication that could occur with that. And from everything I read and from kind of practicality, I know that if I can get somebody to burn more fat as a fuel source, it's going to have a lot better outcomes for cellular respiration, mitochondrial development, and in the long run, endurance performance, and as well as some of this metabolic health that we're talking about. So I'd say from a simplistic standpoint, again, knowing how your engine is running rather than just the output is really what we're trying to drive home here. Is that yeah. you could be producing the same power, but you do it in drastically different ways if you're a sugar burner or a fat burner.
And it's probably more important the longer your event gets.
Yeah, 100%. If you're just racing crits.
Yeah, if I get what this quote sugar burner, but he's a crit rider, I don't view that as a limiter of his performance necessarily. Right. But training for SPT gravel, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's come back to this fat burning idyllic scenario where if we have somebody that comes in and we identify that they could do some different training that could utilize fat as a fuel source, what kind of training are we talking about here? And what sort of shift in their training would you tell them to do? And would you be able to get all that information based on a lab test?
Yeah, quite a bit of it on a lab test because it's identifying the specific intensities, the specific, in this case, might be watts or heart rate at which they're making those shifts. And, you know, on a training intensity, I want to improve peak fat oxidation. And it's like a yin yang. Improve their mitochondrial function. That's what I really want to do is improve their mitochondrial function of their slow twitch fibers. Cause that's a really big determinant of your aerobic performance. We talk about mitochondria all the time, powerhouse of the cells and, a limiter of your endurance capability is how good are those mitochondria, and an outcome of the mitochondria being better is better fat oxidation. So, training around your peak fat oxidation, and we can identify that in the lab. And, back to the performance testing and the 20-minute test, that might not elucidate that number for you. And I would say the thing that I get from people coming into the lab is that they have a better idea of how easy they need to go in their, quote, zone two intensity. I think that oftentimes for zone two intensity, people are like, more is better. Like if I'm going to do 150 watts versus 140 watts, I'm going to do 150 watts. And the problem with identifying that intensity for most people without that lab testing is they can often train too hard. So it's getting the result of the lab test is getting them to go easy enough. It's often easier than people think. And then you have to do enough volume there. That might be, where you can interject your expertise on the time crunch side of things is like, that's a limitation on the time crunch side is that, and maybe why the very elite can get to those higher levels is because they're doing 20, 30 plus hours a week, where quite a bit of that is in that low intensity.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the limitations of just identifying yourself as a time crunched athlete, 6 to 8 hours a week, you like straight up to the point, you're not going to realize your full physiological maximum potential on that. We know that. But if you operate within the context of accepting that, now you just work with what you got, you can then move toward your goals and just say, okay, cool. Might not ever be the elite athlete, but that's fine because I have all these other things that are of value in my life, right? So we're not really talking about that necessarily. It's like, if you got 6 to 8 hours a week, what else can we do? How do we get creative with it? And on the podcast, we've talked about, how do we get that extra volume? It's training camps. That's, you know, these dosages of longer rides when you get the green light from the family, when you have some vacation and holiday, maybe you put it into sinking some time in on the bike, those types of things. But that aside for now,
can I interject on the additional activities?
Yeah, please.
Because what I see from a lot of time crunched athletes, they tend to be less efficient on that metabolic side because they spend a lot of time in zone three.
Yeah, good point.
That's just
good
like point. A factor of what they do for training. They don't have the hours to spend in that zone two, so they tend to lean on the sugar burner side. And they tend to be, you know, adding carbohydrates or seeing that suppression and fat oxidation at a lower intensity. And I'm saying, like, these guys could benefit from just more low-level activity. And I mean, like, taking the dogs for a walk.
Yeah, 100%.
Going for a bike ride with kids. Just having more time of your day where you're moving at a low intensity rate that's like mildly aerobic. And I'd also interject there, you're not overfueled during that time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, I mean, the overfuel part, like if you feed your body sugar, it's going to run sugar.
Yeah.
But if you could, you know, spend extended times of moderate to low activity trying to force your body to run on fat as a fuel, that's good. And, you know, I know you're going to interject here, like, we're not taking it to extreme of like, I'm not eating for 24 hours or going to some kind of extreme fasted situation,
yeah,
but just more movement at a low level and not having to fuel at a really high rate while you're doing it. You're going to push your body to preferentially burn fat as fuel.
Yeah. I mean, straight up to the point. I mean, that's exactly it, Renee. And I think to the practical application side of things here, as we are starting to wrap this up, that's exactly it. And I think for our time crunched athletes that have the sense of urgency that I need to like maximize my time and all this kind of mentality that goes into not having time, I think your advice is super sound, where maybe you create some space or you have this time period where you're doing some of these low level activities and you're confident in it. And that's where the lab test can give you that confidence, is to say, hey, actually, if you do this a little lower intensity, you will actually benefit in the long run. So having that confidence of, even if it is on the trainer, right? Like, stay patient, stay disciplined, because now you know too much. You know too much to, you know, pin it at zone four all the time or jump in the group ride every single day. If your goals are to become, quote, more metabolically efficient by burning fat as a fuel source, to staying disciplined and accumulating more time in zone at zone two or aerobic training around LT1 so that you're building metabolic or mitochondria so that you are a better endurance athlete. And I think this is the biggest thing that's so tricky though, Renee, is because when I'm looking at Training Peaks, when I'm looking at my power meter, I don't see that in real time. I can't see my mitochondrial developing. Right. I don't have, and at some point we've talked about this before, where even my fitness score on Training Peaks, the CTL, stabilized. It doesn't move. So if I'm doing 7 hours a week at zone two only, am I getting benefit there?
Yeah, I think there's some ways that you're not gonna see it in the performance manager chart. You're right on.
Yeah.
You're not gonna see it in your power duration curve. But you're going to see it in maybe some other ways. I would say, like, very simply, heart rate response to power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and maybe heart rate response to power, I might just say within zone two, like as a further parameter. That is, can you go for a long time in zone two and your heart rate just kind of stay stable? PW heart rate, that aerobic decoupling, that's a fairly good measure of, am I getting better at this? I might also say, like, how hungry do you get during your rides? Like we talked about this the other week, Adam. Like, can you go on an easy 3-hour ride just not eat anything?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, okay, that's not a performance recommendation. If you want to perform your best, yes, eat something. But if you're able to run on fat as a fuel, you can do a 3-hour ride not eating anything and be fine.
As long as you stay hydrated, right? So drink some water, maybe have some electrolyte beverage, whatever. But yeah, I think too, the practical application side of this is, say you get a lab test or you don't, right? You're doing training, but you want to take this knowledge that we're talking about and apply it. Build yourself up to a trainer ride, at, you know, 1 hour at 70%, 75%, something like that. Like middle top end of zone two. And you might say, well, let's go lower first. And that's fine by me.
Yeah.
But 1 hour at zone two and keep that percentage straight the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Tune into your perceived effort, watch your heart rate. And that perceived effort should maybe start around 4 or 5, build up to like a 5 or 6, but it shouldn't go to like that 7. It shouldn't go to 8, right? In terms of like feeling like a threshold effort, you shouldn't be like increased ventilation. You shouldn't be like dying, right? The heart rate, just in my observations here, your heart rate really shouldn't tick up more than 5 beats per minute during that whole time. It should go up to a point and stabilize the entire time. If it keeps on building and goes high up into zone 3, zone 4, maybe, that's a sign that you need more time in zone 2. So if you want to test it, that's like one kind of practical way. If you want a better way of testing it, go get a lab test.
Good advice.
Yeah. So I guess, Renee, kind of rounding off the practical aspect of things here, let's bring this thing home with a few summary points. And I'd say number one, lab testing is that individuality, valuable aspect to see how and why the engine is running, not just how fast it's going. What else would you add?
I'd say, you know, lab testing can give you if you're going to do lab testing any time of the year, do it now for most cyclists in the Northern Hemisphere of your base phase, because that's where it's going to help you exact your training to a more specific level. And then you could actually see some measurable difference would be, you know, in this base phase or off-season training.
Yeah, because it'll confirm right, like where those LT1, LT2 points are and help you stay disciplined there. And I'd say, like, I don't know, third point, knowing that metabolic flexibility, right, your utilization of carbohydrate and fat at various intensities, that has implications to performance, but also has implications to health and longevity, just in the way your whole life is set up. So that's another strong point to testing. I feel like we keep going here with summary points, but I'll give it to you last to say the last word on this.
Yeah. Right? The last, you know, point on that carbohydrate, fat metabolism, things like that, that is more helpful point for athletes is, how many carbohydrates do I really need an hour? Because I've helped many athletes with that as like an additional fueling strategy of, like, I helped identify one ultra endurance athlete, like, oh, you know what? I don't need to go over 60 grams of carbs an hour because that's all I'm burning. Where another ultra athlete, he was like, almost doubled his carbohydrate intake per hour and, you know, helped himself perform that way. So it's telling us how many fats and carbohydrates you're actually burning to better dial in your fueling strategy.
Look at that, Renee, man, in a day and age where all the social medias and all the companies are saying more carbohydrate, you're telling us that's
for some
more.
People, no,
it just like, be if, marketing.
if, like maybe all you need is 60 grams an hour.
Yeah. 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 That's my point. So, and I think we'll talk about that here in part three. I think it's a good cue for how we take all of the information, wrap it up into one. But I think, yeah, everybody listening here, you can tell Renee is a smart cookie. And if you want to know the individual aspects of how your body is running and if your training's working, go do a lab test. Okay. And then in part three, we're going to talk about once you get a lab test done, how to apply it to your training, start building base. So Renee, thank you again for taking time to come on the Time Crunch Cyclist podcast. Love it. Love everything you do.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us on the Time Crunch Cyclist podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you want even more actionable training advice, head over to trainwright.com/newsletter and subscribe to our free weekly publication. Each week, you'll get in-depth training content that goes beyond what we cover here on the podcast that'll help you take your training to the next level. That's all for now. Until next time, train hard, train smart, train right.